It's mid-April and we're in the middle of a pandemic. We're asking anyone who cares to listen, when does this end? When do we go back to our normal?
This is Terms and Conditions. I'm Nima Iyer.
I'm Berhan Taye.
And this is our second season. The world is in a completely different place than it was when we brought you season one of this podcast. And yes, it has been a very long break, but we are back and we are looking forward to bringing you a complete set of new episodes to satisfy your tech cravings.
Yay. So Nima, what have you been up to this past year?
Well, I guess lots have changed. I moved to Germany. I'm learning German. Guten Tag. Wunderbar. I have done some fun traveling. I went to Turkey last summer and I went to Norway and tried out cross-country skiing for the first time. And in my work life at Policy, we've been doing some really exciting work on, for example, community data art projects, building interactive games around disinformation, and doing lots of research on interesting topics about around tech and digital rights. But tell me, Berhan, what can we expect from season two of Terms and Conditions?
So much. There's so much happening in season two. We're going to be talking about our favorite topics, surveillance or maybe counter-surveillance, digital identity, decolonizing tech in Africa, coronavirus and, you know, Africa and digital rights. So we have a lot of good things packed for season two. In this episode, we're going to unpack what coronavirus means for digital rights in Africa and how tech solutionism is desperate in these times.
Excellent. Let's get started. Berhan, how are things in Kenya at the moment?
So here in Kenya, we have more than 200 cases so far and a handful of deaths. International flights are banned. So technically, we're all stuck here. There's a dusk to dawn curfew. So what that means is that you have to be home by 7 p.m. And you can't leave your house until it's 5 a.m. And those in Nairobi, Mombasa, and a few other cities are not allowed to leave the city because they're the hot spots for the virus. I must admit, though, that it has not been easy for a lot of us. At least you and I don't necessarily have to worry about losing our jobs or thinking about where the next meal is going to come. But for a majority of people here and across the continent, you know, jobs are not secure. People are struggling with figuring out where the next meal is going to come. And many people that have kids, for instance, that I know, have sent their kids to the countryside so that they don't necessarily have to worry about feeding them or, you know, being able to commute from their work to their homes. So, and government response, of course, has been quite commendable in terms of quarantining and controlling the virus. But, of course, they've also used excessive force to implement the curfew, where at least two people have died, including a 13-year-old boy, as police were trying to enforce the curfew. So that's where we are.
That's pretty crazy. We've also asked some of our colleagues from across Africa to give us a snapshot of what life has been like over these past few weeks.
Hello, my name is Charles Kojo Van Dyke. I'm in Accra. I'm a Ghanaian. Experiencing partial lockdown. I'm working from home. It's been quite a different experience for me, working remotely. Of course, we've had to adhere to social distancing, etc. It's been quite topsy-turvy and quite crazy and different, but we are hanging in there.
Hello, my name is Philip, speaking from Kampala, Uganda. Life under the lockdown is structurally different. I'm not able to access some of the life's essential services, especially those that are not online at all. I can't access any transport means, but I think on a positive note, I have been able to do some self-realization. Over the past few weeks, I've actually realized that I can work from home. I had never really considered the idea of working from home full-time because I'm not one with a good attention span. But over the first few weeks, I've realized that I can be super productive working from home and achieve so much more. I think that is super exciting for me and a great thing.
Yeah, so these experiences that we hear from our colleagues in this part of the world is not really different from what's happening in Italy, Spain, the US, India, and others. So, yeah, we're all in the same place, unfortunately.
Yeah. When the pandemic first broke out, there were what I would say is four main approaches to tackling the virus, and I'll just name them out quickly. The first one was uncontrolled spread, which means that you allow the pandemic to spread unchecked in order to build herd immunity. This is done with the knowledge that there will be many deaths, but that in the end, it will all be worth it and there will be lesser disruptions, for example, to the economy. The second one is a lockdown with income replacement. And we've seen this in the examples of Germany or Denmark, where governments have done direct cash transfers, for example, to freelancers to help offset their lack of income. And this helps to slow down the spread of the virus while reducing anxiety, while reducing the need for people to go out and to panic. The third one is a lockdown without income replacement. And this is occurring in a lot of countries in Africa, in Southern Asia. So it's a lockdown, but people aren't being compensated in any way. It's leading to economic devastation. Many countries are already going into a economic recession. And we're also seeing a lot of an infringement of human rights. As Burhan already mentioned, you know, that I've seen images of people being beaten in Kenya if they don't have a mask, for example, or if they're seen on the streets. We've also seen this across India with migrants having to walk many, many miles to get back home. It almost seems that in some countries, more people have been killed by violence than from the virus itself. And the fourth one is testing. And this has been done in many countries in the Far East where they've launched these really mass testing programs with the aim of containment to control the spread of the infection so that it leads to less amounts of economic disruption. The first one I mentioned, uncontrolled spread, was thrown out the window quite rapidly. Countries who followed lockdown with income replacement are slowly flattening the curve. Like here in Germany, things do seem to be getting a bit better. And then we have lockdown without income replacement. And those doing testing and those categories of countries are resorting to technological means of surveillance and tracking. And it's understandable that you want to protect the people. But what we're trying to ask in this episode is, at what cost are we doing this to our future selves?
So that's a really important question, right? Like, so the impact of the lockdown is not proportional. So we've seen in countries where they are under a strict lockdown, for instance, in South Africa, France, the UK, even here in Kenya, domestic violence has really risen in the past few months, in the past weeks particularly. So there are free toll numbers that women can use to call for help if they find themselves in that kind of situation. In Ethiopia, for instance, all courts are closed, but the Chief Justice came out a few days ago saying that a few courts will stay open to deal with the domestic violence issues that will most likely arise when we go into a lockdown.
Yeah, and that makes sense. Talking about battling the epidemic in these different ways, tackling an epidemic has always required the monitoring of populations to understand and to limit the spread of the disease. And countries around the world have started using different tactics to track and surveil citizens in the name of controlling the pandemic. To give you the example of my father, we had gone, right before the pandemic, we had gone on a vacation to Sri Lanka. And when he returned, 10 days later, you know, somebody knocked on his door and these officials came in and stamped his hand with some kind of ink that doesn't go out. And it had the date of how long he had to be quarantined because of his age. Of course, it was 10 days too late, but when he asked them how they found him, they said that they had tracked him down using his cell phone data. So this brings us to the topic of data privacy concerns in the age of a pandemic. And many tactics have been reported, such as new apps that are being developed or new wearables that can transmit your location. In Taiwan, they have something like that could be related to an electronic fence. So if you are in quarantine, your phone cannot be turned off for more than 15 minutes because they're always tracking your movements. We have seen, for example, in Brussels, they've used drones that fly overhead and shout out orders to people to maintain social distancing. South Korea has used closed circuit television, CCTV, and credit card data to track the movements of individuals. In Israel, about 1.5 to 2 million people have downloaded an app called Hamagen, and it alerts users if they've crossed paths with somebody who was a coronavirus patient. And in India, similarly, a new app called Arogya Setu was launched. You basically sign off your location data and your Bluetooth access to this app, and then it informs you if you have ever been near someone who was infected with the coronavirus by looking against a database of known cases. The app's privacy policy says that your data will not be shared with third parties, that your information is encrypted, but we have seen in the past few days some major, major data mishaps. For example, the state government of Karnataka published the addresses of hundreds of people who were under quarantine. So it's not even, you know, cases, it's people under quarantine. It was done with the intention that people stay away from them, but then it ended up that they got ostracized and people in the public were frightened. And we know that all of this can snowball into something very scary very quickly.
Yeah, so it's not just governments that are responding to the situation from a tech perspective. We've seen a lot of the tech giants also collaborate and launch their own new tools. So for instance, Facebook is launching a new tool that uses anonymized location data collected from users to basically show whether adhering to social distancing measures designed to stop the spread of the COVID-19. Facebook says it won't show patterns around the movement of any specific individuals and won't be used to identify individuals who aren't adhering to social distancing or shelter-in-place guidelines. However, a spokesperson from Facebook claims that the company will explore trends across populations. From Google, for instance, they've published anonymized data of locations of their users. Will this be the new normal?
Yeah, and it's also interesting of what has already been normalized. I saw a picture on Twitter of a delivery app. Similar to other apps, of course, it shows you your driver moving, you know, like on the Uber map. But it also shows you the real-time temperature of your delivery guy, which was pretty mind-blowing to me. Digital surveillance companies such as the Israeli NSO Group or the facial recognition company Clearview AI, they've been already involved in some pretty massive controversies around people's privacy. And we have other companies like US-based Palantir, and they all work very closely with the intelligence and defense communities and have been slowly trying to chip away at the global privacy. And they've all been really quick to jump at these new opportunities and this new easing of regulation by different governments across the world. And this acceptance of the new kinds of surveillance and tracking is now higher than it's ever been, at least since I can remember in the past 20 years.
Yeah. And, you know, if we look back to this part of the world, for instance, we've seen the Ministry of Health in Ethiopia sending people their COVID-19 test results via a plain text SMS. No conversation about, like, you know, telecom companies having access to that data. So for instance, one of the telecom company there is in the process of being privatized. We're not sure what's going to happen with our data. We don't have a data protection commissioner or nor a law. So there's nobody that's going to tell us if that information one day will be sold to insurance companies and will be able to, you know, if one will be able to discriminate against those that, you know, are COVID positive in the long run, right? Like, so they're not really thinking about the long-term implications of the tools that they're using, what that will mean. Similarly, here in Kenya, there are multiple reports that show that the government is going to force public transportation users to register their names and the vehicles that they've used using an app.
What?
So in order to board Boda Boda, well, not necessarily Boda Boda, but like the Matatus, for instance, you need to have registered on this app. And the idea is like, so the idea is that, you know, if somebody that has taken a certain route is infected, then you'd know who all the people were on that bus that was at that were at the same time. No idea how that's going to work, how it will help.
Wow.
But at least we know it's being developed by a third party. And when you go to their website and click on the terms and conditions and privacy policy, guess what? It doesn't lead you anywhere. So, you know, that's how much thought that has gone through that process, right? And of course, again, in South Africa, telecom companies have said that they're sharing data with the government. And what they're basically saying is that it's going to help with analytics. There's no information about how that data is going to be used, which part of government is going to be shared with, what are the measures that are being put in place. And most importantly, I think for us, I think South Africa is an outlier in here because they have a pretty strong data protection law. And, you know, they have that culture that many of us don't. But we don't see the data protection commissioner or those individuals that are there to protect people's information, people's privacy being involved in this process. So that's extremely, extremely concerning. And most importantly, we have to also understand that this will become most likely the new normal when everything is over and when we hopefully, you know, are over this pandemic. Will this be the new culture that we've set where there's that free flow of data from telecoms companies into governments and surveillance structures?
For me, the question is there a time limit to this? Because of course, once these apps start getting used, then there's no going back. Once people get used to using these apps, it makes me think that governments are not going to withdraw the need. So every time you use public transport, you have to use an app, and then the government can keep track of you. But they might never tell you to stop using that app, even after the pandemic is over. That makes me think of an example that I read in France, where there was an amendment to table a bill to authorize telecom operators to collect health and location data on all mobile phone users. But there was a timeline, and it was 6 months. And it didn't make it through. But this is happening across the world on an ad hoc basis. And there's no timeline that's being given, as far as I can see, for many of these governments. So we're seeing that, you know, even here in Europe, who have been at the forefront of protecting citizen privacy, that even they are now opening their hearts and giving their blessings to these new initiatives that give up our data and our privacy for the foreseeable future.
I 100% agree with you. That's the scary part, is that in places where there's really good protections of, you know, fundamental rights, these conversations are still happening. And, you know, someone is bold enough to suggest something like that in a parliament like the French parliament, for instance. So for me, I think the bottom line is that regulators are giving their approval to practices that will almost be impossible to take away once the pandemic has passed. And in a lot of places, the regulators are not even part of this conversation, right? So that's the most scary part, right? We've put these institutions, we've created all of these, you know, infrastructures and frameworks so that they can be, you know, the guards, the safeguards that we would have when this happens. But that's not the thing, that regulators are nowhere to be seen. So civil society, you know, in different parts of the world has come together to ask governments to ensure that the pandemic is not used as an excuse to broaden surveillance and to make sure data is erased once the health crisis is over. Which, you know, if I'm being, I'm trying not to be a pessimist, but if we're being honest, most likely won't happen. So I think our experience from, like, if you look at the US's experience when it particularly comes to the Patriots Act, is quite telling, where somebody the other day was saying that the Patriot Act was drafted in the late 1990s, then became like a thing when 9/11 happened, and after that it just became the new normal. So we might most likely be heading in this direction where there is a direct channel for data aggregation and you know, amassing of individuals' information, and that being used for profit and you know, for public health as well.
Agreed. Now I want to pivot and talk about techno-solutionism, which we mentioned at the start of the episode. Who is jumping in to save the day, and who is just looking for a quick buck to monopolize a difficult situation? In these times, big tech companies continuing to win. Amazon is aggressively hiring more workers. Large stream companies and YouTube are winning big with everyone at home. I've started watching Tiger King. It's so trashy. It's so terrible. I can't stop. And Microsoft said that the numbers using their software have climbed by nearly 40% in a week. I've just been asked to download Teams for some meeting. How is it different from Skype for Business? I don't know. Of course, there's others like Airbnb or Uber who have suffered devastating losses, but it's worth exploring, how did these monopolies come to exist in the first place? How will they use this pandemic to further their profits? I've been reading a lot more these past few weeks, and I often feel like I don't really have any other choice than to buy my ebooks on Amazon. I think it's amazing, the very fact that I can decide I want to read this, and then I can click a button, and then I have the book in front of me. But how did we get here that Amazon is the only choice? There's so many books, there's so many authors, and seemingly such few buying options. And this reminded me of these organizations that came together here in Germany. It was about 30 civil society organizations, and they are demanding for an active digital ecosystem that offers people a choice of platforms and infrastructure so that we're not having to depend on these gigantic tech companies in the times of crisis. And I'm just going to read you a little bit from their declaration. It's a bit wordy, but I'll give it a go. So it says, we call for the promotion of decentralization and a broad ecosystem of digital infrastructure operators in order to achieve digital sovereignty and dissolve dependencies on individual providers through the dismantling of operator monopolies and the consistent use of open standards, free and open source software technologies. So all this to say that democracies should steer digital technology companies away from this data grab. It should hold them accountable to develop effective and transparent tools that aggressively shield our individual privacy. I think if you take a bigger picture view, what I have found interesting is that many of the social challenges which seemingly had no solutions suddenly have solutions. And here I'm talking about homelessness, food distribution for the poor, the environmental impacts. Oh man, the air quality in Kampala at the moment is like amazing. There's like little asthmatic kids, I'm sure, who didn't even know that air could be this clear. And there's other points that are coming up, like who is an essential worker? Previously, we were happy paying, you know, people working in shops, teachers, very, very meager salaries. And now it's coming out that in these times, they're the ones who are saving the day. Talking about nurses and healthcare workers, a lot of hospitals across the world have been underfunded. Even in developed countries, they don't have enough masks and protection for the healthcare workers. If we look at the African context, there's been so much corruption in the healthcare sector, people swindling money that's meant for drugs, and it makes you ask, how are there so few ICU beds in so many of these pretty large countries? And I read a tweet, it said that South Sudan has 4 ventilators and 5 prime ministers, which blew my mind.
And even in the way that we've responded to this crisis, you know, violent responses from governments, little care for vulnerable people, you know, like it's just the idea that you're beating people that are going home 2 hours before the deadline of the curfew, telling them to go home so that they won't be killed by the virus, just doesn't make any sense at all. So we just need to, hopefully, you know, when we come out of this, and if we do, we need to really, really think our entity and as humanity in this world, because otherwise this just can't be the new normal.
I think it's an interesting time to think about how we can change what the status quo was to make it more of a future that we want. And of course, we can go in that direction, or we can regress and go in a direction where all our freedoms are taken away from us. We need to keep our sanity in these interesting times. We're staying indoors, but we're still out there. So we've come up with some tips for you guys so that we can end on a high note. And these are tips from Burhan and I. I have been working remotely, offline, for most of my career. And my number one tip is block off chunks of time that you're going to work. So decide that I'm working from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. and then I'm going to work from maybe 2:30 to 6 p.m. But importantly, you need to decide when you're done for the day. So you're going to say that at 6 p.m., my work day is finished. I'm closing my laptop and I'm doing something else. Because once you're at home, you just sit on your laptop and then suddenly it's 7, 8, 9. And I think that that blurs the line between what is work time and what is your time. The second tip is that you don't need to learn a new skill or write your next big novel. We're all going through something that's pretty massive and pretty anxiety-inducing and very unpredictable. So it's okay to just relax and to just take things easy. You don't have to be ultra productive in these times of corona. Our third one is that not all meetings need to be video calls. When we couldn't meet in person, suddenly everything has been converted into a video call. And just as it goes that, you know, some meetings could just have been emails, some video calls could just have been a Slack message. So we don't have to get so bogged down in video call after video call each day. I think we need to prioritize how we're using our time and be more efficient about our energies. And the last one is popcorn is a great snacky snack with few calories. All right, that's it. And take care. Stay safe. Stay indoors. We'll catch you next time. I'm at Nima Ayer on Twitter.
I'm at BTAYEG on Twitter. Bye.
My name is Ahmed Simba, and I currently speak from Kigamboni area in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania. There is no lockdown in Tanzania, and the life on most parts of the country is as usual. The government is still searching about 900 people believed to have had contact with those who have tested positive. But there are people like me who have decided to stay at home. We work at home. We work from home. And I know a number of pensioners, mostly old people, who have decided to stay at home to avoid any contact with people outside. You know, our country is known to have the culture of friends sitting together in evenings for chit-chat over a cup of tea or traditional coffee. These occasions are very rare now. If I'm allowed to talk about myself, in the last 15 days, I've gone out of my house twice. But I can imagine how difficult it is for people to be quarantined, especially because, you know, in our country, people do not have savings and they work hand to mouth. So it would really be difficult for them to be quarantined. They will definitely have to struggle with hunger. The good thing is most people now know about coronavirus, and they try their best to take preventive measures. For the people who have professionals that allow them to work from home, like me, the coronavirus has not very much affected our lives yet. But we know the economy of our country will very much be affected as a result of this virus.